Gary Burris, and I'm here today to talk to you about what's happening in the European Union as far as gun rights are concerned. I've heard a lot of people here, and all are great speakers. I'm not a great speaker, but I'm very passionate about what I'm involved in. I brought along my teleprompter just in case. Basically, the situation in the European Union is not bad. The gun laws there are controlled basically by something called the EU directives. Those could be compared to our federal gun laws. They're generally recognized and complied with by other non-members of the European Union. Gun registration is mandatory in most places. Fully automatic weapons are prohibited in most places, with the exception of a few individuals that have special collector's licenses. But in general, we can say the situation in the EU is not much different than, say, California or Massachusetts or perhaps New York. Maybe it's better than in New York. But to understand the differences between the U.S. and the EU is, in the United States, it's permitted for folks to sell firearms, to own and possess firearms. In fact, if they own, sell, or trade in firearms, they have licenses to do that can be denied them or revoked. However, the right to keep and bear arms is a right. It's not something that's given to us by our Constitution. It's guaranteed by the Second Amendment. However, in the European Union, it's pretty much the opposite is true. It's important to understand the similarities, too. Through the help of the Second Amendment Foundation, we've been fighting for gun rights and winning cases. For instance, I support a couple of gun rights organizations in Europe, and rules and regulations for gun ownership and usage is pretty liberal in countries like Germany and Austria. However, they have some restrictions there in the fact that they can't move and shoot at the same time, like IPSC or IDPA shooting matches. So, having said that, the reason they do that is because the police have said that moving and shooting is a prerogative only of the military, or it's for public safety reasons we won't allow you to do that. But we're going to change that. We're going to try to change that. My friends in Europe asked me to help them out by forming a shooting association. There's lots of shooting associations in and around Europe, but none of them are willing to stand up for their rights. They're afraid of their governments, okay? So I founded the Lone Star Shooting Association. LSSA is a nonprofit Texas corporation, and we help raise money to fight for gun rights around the world. And it's kind of patterned after the Second Amendment Foundation, and I had some meetings with Alan and Julianne about that when we formed it, and they've been very helpful. In Europe, it's caught on like wildfire. There have been at least 50 three-gun matches held in Europe this year alone. People just love it, and they really enjoy shooting multiple type guns in a single match. So I partnered with FISAT, the Italian gun rights organization. I even did a little video to help them out because there was a law being proposed, a bill presented, the 2012 bill, that would have instituted a cataloging system, something similar to what they have in California, where if your gun was not in this catalog, you couldn't own it. So we actually defeated that bill. And we actually stopped an amendment that was proposed to that bill that would have required owners of military look-alike guns to have, not keep them at home, they would have to have kept them at the gun range. So by and large, we've been pretty successful there. The bottom line is that there are other countries around Europe who have seen these successes that we're currently having there, and they're asking us questions about can we come and help them. So LSSA is a very important part of that puzzle, as is the Second Amendment Foundation. LSSA is a member of IAPCAR, and I'm sure somebody's going to speak more about IAPCAR later, a whole, you know, bowl full of these funny letters. Anyway, I'd like to thank you for allowing me to come and speak to you. Even though I'm not a great speaker, like I said, I am very passionate about what I do. And I'd like to invite all of you to come to the first World Three-Gun LSA Championship match that's going to be held near Houston the end of May of 2013, the weekend before the NRA convention is there. Thanks again to the SAF. Thank Julianne and Alan for their help. And God bless America.
Good morning. It's my pleasure to be here this weekend as the president of Canada's National Firearms Association, and I bring greetings from the 5 to 7 million Canadian firearms owners to the freedom-loving people of the Second Amendment Foundation and the Citizens Committee for the Right to Keep and Bear Arms and the freedom-loving people of Florida and the other states of your great union. I'm a volunteer. I'm not a paid lobbyist. I have a day job. I teach at a community college. And I'm here to speak for the Canadian firearms owning public. As we are well aware up north, elections make a big difference to civil rights. And I'm here to tell you what a big difference an election can make. First, in our last federal election, our conservative government changed from a minority position to a majority position. Now, without going into the nuances of our system, that meant that for the past 75 or so years that we've suffered under basically anti-firearms governments, successive progressive, conservative, and liberal governments, especially liberal ones, which have eroded our firearms rights. And part of that has been a direct reaction to American laws, such as your 1968 Gun Control Act. I think things really started to get bad after that in Canada. And the conservative goal of the party in power now is really to erase the old Trudeau liberal vision of Canada and replace it with a conservative one. Now, the conservatives in Canada have made some significant promises to garner the support of Canadian firearms owners. They promised to repeal the 1995 Liberal Firearms Act. This promise morphed into repealing a small part of that act, which was getting rid of the long gun registry. And they have done that, and for that we are extremely grateful. Because that kind of thing that we have happen to us in Canada can very much happen to you in the United States. Now, while ending the long gun registry was very helpful, there is so much more to do to repair our badly damaged firearm system in Canada. Given that all other parties in the Canadian Parliament are openly hostile, it's really nice that the Canadian conservative government has enjoyed the support of firearms owners. In addition to ending the long gun registry, the conservative government has done a number of other things. They've strengthened self-defense laws. They have taken a refreshingly critical position on the arms trade treaty talks and on the program of action on small arms and light weapons. And under previous governments, Canada was an important supporter of global gun control. And I am very pleased to tell you today that that position has changed. They don't go as far as I would like to see, but it's a lot better than it was. And regardless of those changes, our opponents at the United Nations and our opponents around the world are not going away, and all of us need to remain vigilant and involved at the UN so that our freedoms there do not suffer by proxy, by people going there and giving away our rights and freedoms. Other things that our government has done is they've adopted a firmly pro-Israel position instead of a neutral one, which has been the case before. They passed laws to crack down on violent criminals and also steps to increase prison sentences. They reversed liberal gun regulations that have never been enforced, such as our proposed gun show regulations, which are now not going to happen. They've also repeatedly delayed implementation of the UN marking and tracing regulations, and it's not clear if these are going to be terminated, but we're pushing for it. Now, it's important to understand that the decisions of this conservative government in Canada are not popular with liberal elites and many elements of the mainstream media. While firearms owners want much more done to reduce our onerous laws, I must acknowledge that scrapping the long gun registry, although it's a small part of change that's needed, was not easy for that government to do. It was intensely partisan. Only two members of the opposition voted with the government to make the change. And the law met a similarly partisan reception in our upper house, our Senate. Prime Minister Stephen Harper had to suppress a rebellion among gun control bureaucrats by passing new regulations restricting the power of our provincial firearms officers, which are administered by the Royal Canadian Mounted Police. And the RCMP as a firearms bureaucracy has not been very helpful in sorting out that bureaucracy. It's a very entrenched liberal bureaucracy that is very anti-firearms that we're dealing with. Presently, we're engaged in two major court battles to fight challenges to the law that eliminated the long gun registry. One arises from an Ontario government-funded women's shelter, and a preliminary injunction filed by that party demanded that registry records be preserved was recently quashed. And I'm glad of that, because that may make the rest of their case somewhat moot. However, the main fight is to continue next spring, and we have applied for friend of the court status in order to fight that. The second fight is a challenge to the law by the province of Quebec. Quebec is demanding that it receive full access to the registration records of the citizens of that province as a right under the Division Powers section, and we are expecting that these legal fights could cost a lot of money, but they are fights that need to be fought. And I'm almost done, Julianne. I know that you're there. I feel your presence. Our main problem in Canada is that the oppressive Firearms Act and regulations are still in place to limit access, legal access to firearms, while doing little about illegal access. In Canada, owning a firearm has been a crime since 1998, unless you have that federal license. And so the big problem in our act is modifying that to get rid of that license or fix that problem so that people can once again have the right to own firearms. That's a liberal initiative which is still supported by our conservative government. That must change. I encourage people of all nationalities who value freedom to be active in politics and support candidates who stand for rights and freedoms. Ask politicians questions, hold them accountable, and remind those with power that mandates come from people who vote, and get out and vote. Canada's National Firearms Association has taken the opportunity to support civil and human rights to firearms ownership and self-defense, both domestically and at the United Nations. And I am here today to tell you that we will continue to stand with our allies in defense of freedom. Thank you very much.
I'm Alan Youngman. I'm the Executive Director of the Defense Small Arms Advisory Council. We're made up of most of the U.S.-based military small arms manufacturers. I'm going to talk to you about the Arms Trade Treaty for just a few minutes. The Arms Trade Treaty is being negotiated in the United Nations General Assembly. The U.S. does not have a veto there. I'm going to ignore him. The U.S. does not have a veto. So it's got to be a negotiations process. The second thing to understand about the Arms Trade Treaty is it's not a small arms treaty, at least not labeled as such. It's supposed to apply to all conventional arms. It's been going on for about 6 years now. It will continue to go on. We'll talk about that in just a minute. DSAC has been there. Second Amendment Foundation has been there. NRA has been there. In fact, that's where I met Alan and Julianne about 6 years ago. What the treaty is supposed to be about is regulating the international transfer of conventional weapons, tanks, artillery pieces, fighter aircraft, submarines, things like that. What it's really about is small arms. It's supposed to be about dealing with the global black market. Think about Victor Boot. Think about Connex's full of rusty old Kalashnikovs being moved around Africa with no paper, that sort of thing. And it's supposed to ultimately require parties, the states that sign it, to adopt export licensing regulations, just like the U.S. has, but most countries on earth do not have them. What it's really about is small arms control. There are four driving factors. There are four kind of groups of stakeholders who are pushing this thing. One of them is Australia, the UK, the EU. They have really two interests there. One is they say that the a treaty would make it easier for them to engage in the global trade, aerospace primarily, by leveling out the export regulations internationally. African countries, you know, they see firearms very differently sometimes than we do. They see those leftover Kalashnikovs as being a source of civil unrest, revolutions, famine, refugees, and things like that. Then you have the NGOs, IANSA, Oxfam, Amnesty International, Control Arms, and folks like that, for whom this is providing a very good living. And finally, you have Mexico. Mexico is one of the major factors. There is this inherent political need in Mexico to blame the United States for things. It's not limited to this issue, but this issue is a good chance for it to play out. Why are we involved? Well, where's Jeff Knox? There he is. Jeff's absolutely right. The United States Senate is the most critical part of this whole algorithm. It's great to have the presidency. We got to have the Senate. The Senate is the last line of defense on issues like this because they have to ratify a treaty. However, the Senate is also, as I said, the last line of defense. How many military veterans we have here? Thank you for your service. A fundamental military principle is you defend as far forward as possible. You don't just stand on the objective and wait to get hit. Being engaged at the UN is a big part of that strategy. We may not like what comes out of the UN process. We're going to like it a whole lot less if we're not involved in it. The U.S. position from when this first came up in 2006 up until about 2008 was, guys, this is a really dumb idea. If the whole idea of the treaty is to have nations adopt export licensing regulations for arms, why don't you all just go home and write regulations? We'll send you a copy of ours. You can cut and paste and adopt those in your own country, and we won't need a treaty. Unfortunately, appeals to reason don't always work at the UN. I know, it's shocking. So we began to see an evolution in the U.S. position sometime in 2008, a recognition there's going to be a treaty. If the U.S. continued to boycott the process, stay out of it, we were going to lose the ability to influence it. So our current position is that we can support a treaty subject to a whole bunch of conditions. Why the change? It was not just the change of administration. It was a realization that we needed to update our strategy to reflect reality. The U.S. has 10 red lines, 10 conditions. One is the treaty must be adopted by consensus. That means everybody has to agree. And as some of our British friends said, well, that sounds like the U.S. wants a veto. And the U.S. position was, and your point is? That's exactly what we want. The second U.S. red line, I'm going to read it. A verbatim quote, an ATT will not undermine Second Amendment rights or other U.S. constitutional or legal protections. That is our bottom line. That is the U.S. government's position at the UN. I'll talk more about that in just a second. We convened a month-long conference in New York in July. It began with a chairman's draft, which is a compendium of all the things that have been said about the ATT over the previous 5 or 6 years. The central provision was the scope. This treaty shall apply to international transfers, transfer being defined as physical movement of arms into or out of a country and a change of ownership or control. Our friends in Mexico were successful in adding an or a change of physical possession or control, with or without any physical movement. What's that mean? That means domestic firearm sales will be subject to the Arms Trade Treaty. Mexico looks at this issue very differently. They directly attacked our Second Amendment. Their statement early in the conference was, individual rights, the Second Amendment, cannot exonerate state responsibility for bad things that happen to guns that are stolen or smuggled. Why is Mexico interested in this treaty? In November of 2010, the government of Mexico contracted with a New York law firm to develop ways to sue U.S. gun manufacturers and dealers. to hold them responsible for guns that are illegally smuggled into Mexico and provided to the drug cartels. They're charged with looking at things including civil RICO, and they don't believe that the Protection of Lawful Commerce and Arms Act of 2005 will stop them, particularly not if there's a treaty in effect that has implications for domestic sales. The U.S. position, I'll just summarize it by saying, not going to happen. So over the course of the month, the bad language went away. The treaty is kind of sort of starting to take shape around, yep, it really applies just to brokering, export, import, and things like that, international transfers. Why did Mexico's plan fail, or why has it failed so far? Number one reason, the U.S. delegation stood up. I was very proud to be there to watch a bunch of great Americans standing up for this country and saying we're not going to do it. The political climate created by, for example, 58 senators signing letters saying this is not going to happen obviously helped, but we had some great Americans representing us there. You're going to hear from one of them during the lunchtime. The chief of the U.S. delegation is here, one of my personal heroes. The other reason was Second Amendment Foundation was there. We were there, the NRA was there, standing behind our delegation to counterbalance all of the anti-gun NGOs that were there. It's like Mark Barnes said, where's Mark? Okay. We couldn't afford him to stay much longer anyway, right? Okay. Mark's right. You've got some good folks in government out there who are doing the right thing. We need to recognize them. We need to support them because we want to encourage that kind of behavior. The outcome at the end of July was the treaty failed. Even though most of the most objectionable provisions were gone, there were still some real problems with it. And Ambassador Maley may talk about that a little bit later on, but the amendment process, for example, anything you couldn't get through the basic treaty, you could get through a simple majority vote and amendments, and that's just not good. Who got blamed for it? The international press and the U.S. press blamed the NRA and the other pro-gun groups. I think that's a good thing. I think it's a real compliment. What's next? First of all, it's not over. Probably never will be. We'll be back at the UN in October. Mexico is going to try to cram through a simple majority vote. Probably that's going to fail. Probably what we'll see is a new conference next March to pick up where we left off. Last thing I want to talk about, what can you do? Stay engaged. Your senator needs to hear from you on this issue. Let him know that you're tracking the issue, you know what's going on. Stay informed. Frankly, if somebody wants to send out emails saying Hillary's already signed it, the black UN helicopters are coming to get your guns, if that's for fundraising, that's great. But we need to know that's not exactly what's happening. We need to know what is happening so we can talk to our legislators and their staffs. The third thing is, know who your friends are, know who your enemies are, and keep them separate. Thank you very much.
I'd like to thank Adam. I spent 6 weeks in New York, which is not the greatest place to spend your summer or your winter or anything else. But so I'd like to give them a round of applause and then have our panel and Stand Your Ground come up.